Well, the just to sort of get the formality out of the way, this is based on the work.
Maybe I've already done so by chosen a Blackboard talk.
Thank you. This is done in collaboration. The work that I'll be talking about is done in collaboration with Tony Padilla from Nottingham. And the first paper is out at HAPTH. And there is a couple of more, at least two more in preparation, hopefully. A longer version with more details should come out within a week, and then there is something. Well, anyway, I mean, stay tuned is what I'm trying to say. I view this very much a work in progress, okay? But in order to describe it, I think I should actually start by first telling you what it is not, okay? I am not going to claim that the idea that I'm going to tell you about is a solution to the cosmological constant problem, yet. Whether it can be made into one or not, I don't know. Not yet, okay? I find some of these things intriguing and interesting. I will continue thinking about it. But it's not yet at all clear to me how to get it, you know, to the sort of full-blown thing. But I will claim that we have found a funny little loophole that provides us with a workaround for the Weinberg-Nogo theorem, for the adjustment mechanism in the four-dimensional effective field theory, in a specific limit, in a limit of decoupling gravity. When we namely consider effective field theory of some system of matter fields, okay, where gravity, where we will, in calculation of the vacuum energy that it yields, involve an arbitrary number of diagrams that include any number of internal field theory lines, but not a single internal graviton line. So in this case, gravity is merely a spectator, a probe that measures what the vacuum energy that field theory produces gives, and essentially tests whether it's going to be large or not, and also whether it's going to be perturbatively stable or not. Okay, that's going to be the criterion. So gravitons only appear in external lines as the probes, as the measures, as the detectors of what the vacuum energy may or may not be. They're not allowed in internal loops. If they are put in there in the present form, the mechanism goes awry, okay? The problem comes back and you have to stare it again, and you know, at this point there is not a clear solution. Perhaps it can be found by various tricks and things. I can speculate about that later on. But let me first get to the point of actually just trying to give you a little bit more detail, just what it is that we wish to address this. The fact that this trick worked surprised me. I did not expect it. I actually, this sort of started by, you know, attempting to understand, to explain to myself and to my friend why some of the ideas that people have been trying over the years failed. And then suddenly, in a shock, I mean, something seemed to come together. So let's talk about the problem first, setting up the framework. Here is your GR. Think of it again in the quote-unquote open bracket, semi-close bracket, classical end quote limit, meaning gravity is to be only a classical spectator. This is the matter sector, the matter Lagrangian, which of course involves a number of fields in their conjugate momenta and minimally couples to the metric. Now, the vacuum energy calculation that you would have wanted to do for this would be essentially a computation of the expectation value of this matter Lagrangian to an arbitrary order in the quantum loop expansion. Where, you know, diagrammatically what you're doing is basically, well, summing various types of bubble diagrams, etc. It is sufficient to truncate yourself to the limit of only bubble diagrams because of the fact that whatever vacuum energy is going to be essentially seen by all types of diagrams with external lines. But the covariance of general relativity actually tells you that whatever else you see at any number of external graviton lines is going to already be coded by the bubble limit to start with. They're going to be the same contributions. For good measure, you can also add a classical contribution to this. Because it's there, in principle. No symmetry of the theory prohibits it, and you might as well just do this. Keep it in there. Now, the standard perturbative approach to computing these diagrams, computing these contributions to this amplitude, tells you that all of them will go as, well, generically, there may be some exceptions, okay, in some cases, but generically in the standard, and how do you, another important point, how do you compute them? Use equivalence principle. You pick the largest possible Einstein elevator within which you can fit your field theory, and there you do calculation in flat space. Because the you can do that in the limit where you're ignoring internal gravitational lines. That's a perfectly meaningful thing to do. And then through resorting to equivalence principle, you take the result and bring it back into the arbitrary curve space. That is the limit that I'm going to be talking about. That is the setup within which I will work. Okay, and of course, the Weinberg no-go theorem already prohibits the efficiency of the adjustment mechanism even in this limit. But the idea here is to see, you know, if we can manage some way around it, and perhaps think of it as an epsilonic step forward. So in generic situations, the calculations that you do will lead to contributions to the vacuum energy, which are going to go as the fourth power of the UV cutoff of the whatever regulates it. And there will be numerical prefactors, which will be basically order one. But you know, in other words, you could get some loop suppressions through couplings, but then you could also get some enhancements from the symmetry factors, from the multiplication of the diagrams, etc. Whatever. I'm going to simply assume they're of order one, more or less, and that there is no hidden mechanism. Now, if you had supersymmetry, perhaps these coefficients could be made arbitrarily small. But in case when it's broken, they come back and you know become order one when you think of the supersymmetry scale as in fact the regulator. The cutoff for the theory. The problem then is that generically, because of this, you're going to get too large a number, which is, of course, a well-known thing. That is a meaningful statement. You know, people very often you run in the literature in the various types of statements about just what the cosmological constant problem is, which are actually very loose. You know, why is it not big and why is it not small and why is it this and why is it not that is not really meaningful unless you actually know how to calculate this. And in general situations, we don't. The one well-defined problem that you can talk about, actually there are two aspects of the well-defined problem that you can talk about in the context of effective field theory, which is if you are actually doing your calculation, why aren't you finding a mechanism that is going to stabilize in the perturbative sense? The perturbation expansion that contributes to what you would call the total vacuum energy, okay, as number one. And the other aspect of the problem is if you actually manage to find a mechanism that stabilizes your calculational method for determining the vacuum energy from quantum corrections, how will you keep the end result parametrically much smaller than whatever the relevant scale is that controls your dynamics of field theory? Let's say, in the real world, that would translate into the statement that if you find a way of getting a technically natural small value of the what you call the vacuum energy, how do you make it significantly smaller than, let's say, the Higgs mass to the fourth, or GeV to the fourth? There are also other aspects of the problem, namely what happens with phase transitions and whatnot. But let's focus on this first. If I have time and if you have patience, I will actually comment about what happens with phase transitions as well within this setup. Just turns out magically that they're negligible, actually. Fine. So what do you encounter in GR when you operate within this system of premises? So you say, okay, I do my one loop calculation. I thought there was nothing, suddenly I get, I don't know, TeV to the fourth, let's say, or M Planck to the fourth, or whatever for the vacuum energy. Then you say, ah, that's fine, but I still have this classical term that I can add to the theory, which has a totally arbitrary value. There is nothing. It's a classical term, which is classical. It's a constant, okay? It's conserved, covariantly, if you like. Nothing in this theory, in this limit, fixes it for you. You can choose it to be whatever you want. So you say, fine, now I'm going to consider this and call this the total net cosmological constant that sources gravity, that gravity sees, and decides to call this the cosmological, but that's what it is, thanks to the equivalence principle. And I choose this such that it's equal to that negative that plus epsilon. This is how we were solving, quote unquote, the cosmological constant problem since, you know, if you like, the inception of the beginning of the understanding of just what the problem was, namely from Saharov and Zeldovich and so on. The statement is, so calculate whatever you calculate quantum mechanically, add a classical part to cancel it, and choose that to be small, well, initially until 95, 96, we thought it should be zero. Then beyond that, we sort of decided, well, it can't be zero. It's got to be some tiny number. And then this is what, let's say you do this at one loop level. Then you include a two loop correction. And that gives you another term like so, where C2 is comparable to C1. Roughly speaking. And that means now when you have now corrected your perturbative expansion, you have to choose a totally different classical value of lambda to adjust it by shifting it by order one. But it's a classical value. It's an integration constant in the theory. If you choose the classical value that is dramatically different than the one that you started with, it really means that you have chosen a wrong initial condition for your universe in the first order of your perturbation expansion for the vacuum energy, and you had made a tremendously large mistake. And if you quantify that numerically, that mistake will be, I don't know, 10 to the 60 or 10 to the 120, whatever you think your cutoff is. And that at some point has to start annoying you. In a way, it is essentially equivalent to the problem that has annoyed people into you know, looking for other types of physics beyond the standard model, which stabilizes the Higgs mass. It's morally the same thing. So it's either you accept either to the necessity of fine-tuning this, you know, till death does it part you or whatever. You ignore the problem and shrug it off. You may invoke a miracle. You say, well, fine, this is all good and well, but you know, what if I just perform, I sum up all the loops. I go, I just write all the loops, I sum them all up, and then I just choose my classical value and, you know, it's fixed. Except you don't know how to sum all the loops. You don't even know what loops are there, really. Because you only know what loops are there up to TV scale that include the standard model, but what lies beyond, you don't know. There may or may not be other stuff. So really, this type of argument is actually very sensitive to your ignorance, and at some point it has to make you feel unpleasant. Or not, okay? The alternative, of course, is to, at some point, run into the landscape or some such thing. Look for some classical dynamics which allows for lambda to change locally. Then carefully engineer a distribution of probability for these classical values of lambda that you need in order to give you the right answer. And at some point, the only way how we learn how to do it is to invoke the entropic principle and simply say, it is it because it is it. You know, it can't be anything else. And yes?
There is a solution here. You're a model of that.
No, it's not a solution. No, it's not a solution. But I'm not, let's not argue about that now. I'm happy to discuss that later on. I might review my attitude about it, but no, I don't think it's a solution, and I'll explain to you why later on. That's fine, absolutely. Okay? I might even mention it in the process of setting up what I will tell you actually fixes the problem that unimodular gravity faces. But, you know, wait and see, and then we'll talk. Okay? Now, so what do you do? Well, in this kind of situation, you're mostly puzzled. And you stare and stare and stare, but you start noticing certain types of things that your theory does feature. First of all, Look at just these two terms. Let's rewrite them like this. That's the classical part, nothing else. Now I'm gonna call this GR, but actually I don't. GR and unimodular gravity are really one and the same thing. The moment you accept lambda for what it is, which is a completely arbitrary classical parameter that you can put in by hand, and that can be anything. It's not fixed by anything in the theory, in the semi-classical limit for sure. This term, as it stands, looks like a Legendre transform. This is, in fact, of the same form as the Legendre transform that you use in quantum field theory when you're trying to learn how to calculate the partition function. You trade an independent variable in the path integral that you call the field for the other independent variable that you call the source that defines the generating functional in the functional expansion that you calculate perturbatively. You sum up the series to a given order in perturbation theory, invert the Legendre transform, and rewrite the effective action or the partition function as a functional of the source. Then when you're calculating physical observables, you take functional derivatives of that with respect to the source, and they're obviously going to depend on the value of the source. But since you're interested in quantum field theory around the vacuum, you choose the source to be zero. This term has precisely the same form. Now you say, wait a second, what are you talking about? This, what am I talking about? I'm telling you that lambda is simply a Legendre transform that traits the independent degree of freedom that is the determinant of the metric for another independent degree of freedom, which is the parameter lambda, which we know is, in fact, an independent free number. But you say, surely that can't be right because of the fact that this is a field, whereas this is a number. But actually, diffeomorphism invariance of general relativity tells you that this field has no content, no local dynamical degrees of freedom. It's pure gauge. And you can make it whatever you want through gauge transformation, I mean diffeomorphism, coordinate transformation. So this is really a number. This is your unimodularity thing. You can make it to be whatever you want. Okay. So choose it to be one. And if you like, you can. And then you have a gauge constraint.
Why is that? Isn't that gauge invariant the total volume?
That's the tricky part. The determinant is not, but the total volume is. Except that the total volume is indeed gauge invariant, precisely because of the fact that once you multiply the determinant of the metric by the measure, the gauge dependence, the Jacobian, had been factored out. Of course, this object is really not well defined in field theory, but if you integrate it over the whole volume of space and time, let's call it omega in the absence of a better term, it in fact is a gauge invariant single number. And what this is indeed the whole point of this little exercise, which actually is telling you that in this setup, what you're really thinking is that you're taking what would have been one independent number, perhaps given by initial conditions, and trading it for another. And that's the unpleasant part, because this independent number, sort of offhand, you can't ever really measure because you don't know the future of your universe. And if this was the number that you were forced to fix in some way, you would be more comfortable with that. But you have unfortunately traded it for another independent number, which you do measure. And when you try to calculate its corrections from field theory, they simply tell you that you just don't know how to do that in the first place. So in some sense, actually, in this way of thinking, general relativity being unimodular gravity due to this arbitrariness of the integration constant is really, if you like, a toy model idiot savant landscape parameterized by all possible values of classical lambda that doesn't change, that's fixed, because that classical lambda put in this way by itself cannot alter due to conservation laws. And the problem then really is finding just on which of these trajectories in this infinite family of solutions you need to be. And the answer is you don't know, because of the fact that your perturbation theory lies to you. All right, so how do we fix this? So you see I'm actually telling you this story in this way with a little bit of wisdom after the fact. Because here, the trick, I hope it's wisdom, by the way. The trick is actually to try to find a somewhat different way of writing down the action, which will trade these numbers back around and allow you to fix this while allowing this to be sort of unfixed, but in a way that doesn't destroy the measurement. So how do we do that? Well, let's continue following this logic of unimodularity a bit more. But before we go there, let's do a little bit of dimensional analysis. So let me erase this action because I need a little bit more space. thank you. Thank you. I always have a conflict with technology, even primitive technology like this. So let's copy this action back there and save it for posterity. For this talk at least. Because it'll be useful to have it. There is that root G. Okay, very good. All right. And so we want, this is our problem, these kinds of things, these loop corrections. So let's call it lambda 1 plus lambda 2 plus lambda 3, 1, 2, 3 meaning the number of loops. The truncation down, yes? Absolutely true. Absolutely true. I have it, but only in the classical limit, only having gravitons in the external lines being attached to that lambda. Absolutely true. Otherwise, you know, who cares? Now, the one thing that we notice is that all of these corrections, no matter how big or small they are in fact dimension 4. That's a simple, obvious thing. So why am I talking about it, right? Well, it's actually useful because this is going to be the hook on which we shall try to hinge the cancellation mechanism, namely the scaling of the term that you want to kill. In perturbation theory, they are. I do know that because of diffeomorphism invariance. Let me demonstrate. That does require a certain special statement that we would normally make anyway, which is that the regulator retains the same scaling invariance, so same scaling properties. In this case, the covariance would be preserved. So let's demonstrate that explicitly. Okay, that's the key point. In order to do this, let us introduce a dimensionless parameter lambda which actually counts the dimension of any dimensional object in here. In particular, I'm going to write any dimensional parameter in the what's called the standard model Lagrangian or whatever in Europe. Let's call it the protected sector of the field theory. Okay, I'm going to say that it is some power of some physical mass. So the power of lambda under which it changes under some kind of scaling transformation will then be basically counting the dimension of this object. And I'll do that essentially by introducing some sort of auxiliary mass scale that I define my flat space Lagrangian to depend on, and then choose to take that flat space Lagrangian and couple it to the metric G mu bar defined like so. In this way, I will rewrite this action. It's the same action. There is no difference. Notice I am not touching gravity itself. All I'm going to do is just say that matter sees this metric. Nothing more than that. I'm not touching this, I'm not touching this, but I am. Telling you this. It really is the same thing because of the fact that when I copy this over in terms of the original metric and isolate the powers of lambda, well, let's call it bar at bar. Okay? I know that through a wave function renormalization, because this is just a number. It's not a field. Lambda is just a number. I can certainly do a field definition that will absorb the scaling parameter lambda into the various definitions of the fields and dimensional scales that appear in this Lagrangian. And we write this in precisely the form I started with. Okay? I am assuming that my regulator sees exactly the same metric G bar. How can I do that? I take a system of Pauli Villars and couple them to the tetrads defined by this metric G bar that involves explicitly the parameter lambda. The moment I've done that, I know that this theory, from however deep in the IR I want to go to however far in the infrared, I mean in the UV, okay, will not spoil the lambda scaling. And in particular, if I now start calculating the corrections to the vacuum energy, let's call this, using, you know, the propagators and scales and couplings with this explicit lambda dependence, and I pull that lambda out front, I know that all of them will go like this. Well, where these parameters will be lambda independent. That's guaranteed. And that follows from the fact that no matter what I do to the field theory, the moment I've defined the regulator in a way that makes sure that the regulator itself only sees the metric G bar and not the metric G, field theory diagrams don't change this because they can't, because they respect the diffeomorphism invariance of the metric that they see. You can even conformal anomaly, even if you calculate conformal anomaly, for example, that's going to change the coefficient of a certain expectation value of some conformal current and whatnot, but it's not going to change the fact that, you know, you still have kilograms to the fourth. Okay? So that's the key statement. So now this thing is actually telling me that I have an organizing principle, just a second, that I have an organizing principle that allows me, without having to calculate all the loops, to loop corrections to vacuum energy, I actually know where they come from. They come in the part of the action which scales as this little lambda to the fourth. That's it. Yes? Say it again. Not yet, nothing. That's totally true. That's just obvious dimensional analysis. Nothing more than that. Nothing fancy so far. All right. Now, next step. Let us now start thinking about this feature in conjunction with the variational principles. That you utilize when you think about unimodular gravity. Let's think about this parameter capital lambda as a free parameter that you can vary with respect to. And find out, you know, this is a free parameter, but you want to see just what type of, you know, is there some way of actually fixing it? Giving it certain value, you know, arranging for it to be whatever. Because in the standard GR, you don't know anything about it. So I want to think of this as a variable, if you like, as a Lagrange multiplier. I want to say, okay, when I write down the path integral for gravity involving this setup, I'm going to also integrate over the possible values of big lambda and, you know, allow all possibilities to somehow contribute and see what happens from the interference of various universes with various power. You know, of course, I'm going to assume that some subtle point exists where the leading order, the contribution will come from the variation of this action with respect to that capital lambda. But now, if I do this to this action in the way that it sits here, I'm going to get a ridiculous statement if I vary with respect to capital lambda, I'm going to get a ridiculous statement that you know, the volume of the space-time, the total world volume of the space-time is zero. That's unacceptable. I don't want that. So I have to fix this action. I have to do something to this, to change this statement. Fine. Let's add this term. Out of the integral, independent of the metric, totally external to everything. Actually, for good measure, let's take it to be the argument of an arbitrary differentiable function sigma. Okay? Yes, I'll say what these things are in a moment, but yes, that's exactly right. This parameter mu has to be here for dimensional reasons. Obviously, because capital lambda is a dimensional object of dimension 4. So this is merely a normalization. This mu is a totally external parameter to everything. Fix it by hand. The important thing is that nothing in field theory ever renormalizes this. You're never going to get any renormalization of this action doing anything in quantum field theory. Now, in quantum gravity, I don't know, but I'm not doing quantum gravity. Okay? Later on, if you'll tolerate me some more, I might even give you some speculation of just what this might be related to in quantum gravity, but I'm not sure. But I am the one other thing I'm making is I'm making this object. This is going to be some scale which actually, in the end, normalizes the scales here. So I'm going to make it scale. I'm going to extract that dimensionless parameter counting dimensions of the mass scales from the field theory sector here, just like I did here. Okay. Now, if I vary with respect to capital lambda, this will not be zero. It's instead going to be this. Where sigma prime is the derivative of sigma, if I think of the whole argument there as z, let's say, so this is d sigma by dz. Think of it as some, you know, you just define some formal z and you do, you know, the differential with respect to lambda is going to be obtained by using the chain rule, you know, usual stuff that Herr Leibniz taught us a long time ago. Fine, very good. So now what I'm doing is I'm basically giving some condition, some statement about how the volume of the universe gets fixed by some external scale mu and some scale, some dimensionless number lambda. But that's not really fixed yet because this lambda in parameter in principle can be totally arbitrary. Yes? Say it again. At this of g bar. Once the determinant of g is fixed and lambda is fixed, this is fixed as well.
No, but there isn't a
constraint. In a moment. Not yet. In a moment. In a moment. You'll see. It's coming. It's coming. Now. Say it again. You will indeed. Hopefully. Now. In order to, if you like, precisely to answer that question, I'm going to say now, because I actually did allow this capital lambda to be a Lagrange multiplier, you know, to be a variable, I'm going to do the same thing with lowercase lambda. Okay? So I'm going to vary this action with respect to lowercase lambda as well. Okay? Once, you know, when you start making a party, invite all of your friends, so why not? Why not? That's fine. Okay? Now, this actually is, of course, variationally necessary because of the fact that so far all I've told you is that lambda simply counts the dimensions, but I didn't tell you what this number actually is. And you need some condition to fix it. If you want to have at least some semblance of a consistent theory that's going to fix the numbers that you're interested in, namely the ratios of physical mass scales, m physical of the field theory, and m Planck that measures the strength of gravity. This part is, that's correct. This part This total thing is non-analytic in Lambda, but this part is still. Okay? And since I am actually doing stuff that does not affect this through loops, I'm not going to worry about it now. Exactly what it means, though, there may be some aspect of this that we are going to see actually later on when we consider just what kind of kinds of solutions of the theory we must latch onto in order to get a semblance of reasonable phenomenology. Okay, but save the thought. So let's vary with respect to this lowercase lambda. Let's just see what happens. Well, this part is trivial. You'll just get something like this after an appropriate rescaling. I'm cheating a little bit. Don't worry about the missing power of lambda in the denominator. This part looks a little harder because of the fact that you have this lowercase lambda floating inside and outside of the matter Lagrangian. But you know that you can take all of that and write it in terms of the metric G bar, and you can take the variation by, again, using the functional chain rule. The variation of this whole thing with respect to lowercase lambda is equal to the variation of this whole thing with respect to G bar, and then times the variation of G bar with respect to lambda. And you know what the variation of this is with respect to G bar. It's the trace of stress energy tensor. And that extra missing power of lambda, lambda to the fifth, moves over to the right-hand side to canonically normalize the stress energy tensor. The important thing is this factor of 4, which counts the dimensions of the object that you're trying to get rid of. Solve the equations. Well, here, I can do it here. Now you see, because of the fact that you have a common factor in both of these, yes? No, I'll tell you, not like this is right, but not sufficiently like this. Not, in fact, it's not even a Harron Davidson. This was something like this was actually originally done by actually, to be totally fair, the parent idea for this kind of stuff goes back to Andre Linde in 1980s that you can trace in a paper called Multiplication of the Universes, blah, 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 which is a complicated setup. Something simpler, more akin to this, was done by Arkady Tsetlin in 91. And it was actually realized even before the paper was published, okay, why that setup doesn't work. And I'll actually comment on that and tell you how this fixes the problem. But in a nutshell, Tsetlin's quantum corrections didn't scale like this. That was missing. Okay? Plus, there was also an issue with radiative instability of the Planck scale. Let's think of this as some sort of space-time averaging of the trace of the stress energy tensor which occupies the universe. You need to know it over the course of its whole evolution in the future. That's the price you're paying. This sounds crazy, that you're going to try to get rid of a number that bothers you now by invoking some evolution from the future. A causal, right? Well, I'm actually going to argue that this is, first of all, this is one number, one constant number, okay? And that fact is not even important for the calculation, for the cancellation, as I'm going to show you shortly. It does, however, appear in the phenomenological equations describing the background of the universe now, and that's why it may and should bother you. But I'm actually going to argue that within the context of field theory, something like this may indeed be inevitable, inescapable. But let's see how that goes. I will, however, at this point, if you have serious qualms, attempt to merely calm you down and tell you that this one monstrously looking a causality leads to no pathologies whatsoever in the limit that I'm looking. There is no, you know, this is a number fixed by boundary condition in the future. You cannot take it back and bring it and just, you know, kill your grandfather or whatever. That's just not going to work. Okay? It's there. You don't know how to measure it. You measure it by going to the future. But let's talk about what that means a little bit later. Now, the one final set of equations which we still have to look at is the variation of the metric. Sorry, of this thing with respect to the metric. Now, of course, that's just going to give us the standard Einstein's equation. Minus, of course, this classical capital lambda. Well, delta mu nu. I prefer the mixed tensors because of scaling problem. But we know what this thing is. By virtue of these two other equations of motion. I eliminated it. Absorbed in the canonical renormalization of the fields through wave function redefinitions and also absorbed into the notion of the physical masses and scale. So it's all gone. This simply counts what you observe. Notice again, remember, look at what lambda is. Capital lambda is fixed by this integral. Once it is fixed, little lambda is determined by the whole history of the universe, but it's a single number. It's a constant. As far as local field theory that sees it is concerned, it just sees a number. It doesn't know where it comes from. This number gets absorbed into the definition of physical scales and parameters. But in turn, it is indirectly related to the whole history of the evolution of the universe. But you can never tell it locally. Okay? Because it's a number. The funny thing about this, of course, is that because this is just a number, and everything is manifestly diffeomorphism invariant, and manifestly locally Poincaré invariant, there is not a single new local degree of freedom that the theory has over and above GR. No problem. This is conserved by itself because it's a number. It's a constant. Yes, and this is, of course, d mu t mu nu is equal to zero by virtue of the equivalence principle and the fact that you have not done anything to the theory. Precisely because of diffeomorphism invariance, that's unbroken, and local Poincaré, that's unbroken, so equivalence principle works. So it's the miracle that, in fact, there is no, and notice what happens here. This is sort of kind of like unimodular gravity with something that fixed the boundary condition with the integration constant, but it's also not the same. You see, you don't have nine equations of motion, and then the 10th comes back to the Bianchi identity. All 10 are here. You have these auxiliary parameters here, one of which is absorbed in the definition of physical scales, and the other is selected by the variational principle that leads to this. So you're essentially constraining the dynamics, if you like, in the phase space of all possible solutions, but in a way that is totally consistent with the rules of local field theory in the limit of semi-classical gravity. Yes?
Find
yes?
Where did that come from? From your head? Or?
You mean where did sigma come from?
Where does this expression come
from? I vary with respect to capital lambda. It's just a simple variational reaction. Okay? In other words, remember, I promoted these into Lagrange multipliers and just imposed the variational equations, or rather, evaluated what they are. Yes?
Look like it means the quantum expectation locally in the state, but you mean the average.
I mean classical. Absolutely. If the notation may be somewhat cumbersome, but yes, you are absolutely correct. However, I'll actually tell you that in principle you can also include semi-classical corrections. There is actually some number of facts I'll have to state about what this needs to be and why it is true. Okay, but so far you're totally right. Okay, so now notice. Suppose now you just focus on the contribution. Where is this? On the contribution to this from the hard vacuum energy. Namely, Thank you. Thank you for helping with my challenge with technology. Don't scare me. Let us think about the hard part from Lambda and how that contributes here. In order to do that, let's say that Lambda, we can split it up as the, let's say, classical momentum part, independent part, okay? Just a, you know, you can have a, by definition, you can insert some classical contribution to the total Lagrangian. If you like, whatever you call the zero, you know, the vacuum energy of your quantum field theoretical vacuum at the classical level. And of course, the quantum corrections to that potential in the effective action approach that you can calculate in the loop expansion, et cetera, et cetera, that now include arbitrary number of loops. And now let's call this part lambda local. This is the part that depends on the momenta, okay, that describes the fluctuations of fields. You know, that contains the propagators, that defines the propagators and scattering amplitudes of individual photons and electrons, et cetera, et cetera. Because this part is momentum independent, namely constant, its space-time average, whatever space and time you integrate over, is equal to itself. So now, I can write down the local contribution of the stress energy tensor of the matter that occupies the universe, namely d from, by varying the the momentum part, momentum dependent part of the matter action, and using this I see that the hard part to vacuum energy has canceled out completely. Automatically follows from this. Okay, this is, you know, to me it was very surprising. Okay, now notice what happens. So all the stuff that you would have normally shoved into vacuum energy sector, truncated to an arbitrary order in the loop expansion, no matter what that order is, simply just goes poof out of the source that produces gravitational background. It's not there. To borrow the word other people used in the past, namely Salas Dimopoulos, Nimar Kani-Hamed, Giyad Vali, and Gregory Gabadadze, it got degravitated, if you like. Okay? That, however, does not yet mean that cosmological constant. Now, what's a cosmological constant? Well, there is cosmological constant in field theory, but then there is also what your friend, the astronomer, calls the cosmological constant, which is what they measure looking, let's say, at Hubble diagram. Essentially, checking whether parallel lines in the universe stay straight all the way out to arbitrarily large distances. And when they see they don't, that they bend in one way or the other, they deduce from the bending rate just what the curvature is, and they call that the cosmological constant. Now, that part is not gone. It's still here. But it is now a purely classical, historic average of whatever other local stuff was occupying the universe and controlling its evolution in its full course, in the past, present, and future. But it's a single number, it's purely classical, and has no contribution from the hardcore vacuum energy at any order in the loop expansion, because that got canceled. Yes?
Suppose you had a region of the universe where, so you had some phase transition,
uh-huh,
but there's some part of the universe where it's not going to phase transition and some other distance.
Yes?
Then
I'll talk about phase transition shortly. Let's save the thought. Okay? There could be, in principle, some potentially dangerous situation there, okay? But I'll argue that, in fact, well, okay, let's talk about that. That's going to be related to the selection of phenomenologically acceptable cosmology within which you can live. Now, in principle, this number could be, well, a priori anything, okay? It's, if you like, if you try to use some sort of FRW description of the universe to see what this number would be, then this would be something like rho plus 3p integrated over all space and time, and then divided by the wall volume of the space and time. And, you know, because rho plus 3p can have arbitrary sign without any, you know, pathologies ever appearing, namely you satisfy all the energy conditions normally and whatnot, you can still have any sign. In principle, it can have any value, etc. Okay? But before we actually go to this, it could even be zero. Okay? Or not. The problem would be if I ended up generically predicting that in a universe where such a cancellation occurred, I ended up having to deal with a huge classical number. If this number were huge, no matter that it's now loop independent, you know, I would then immediately go take my hat off and say goodbye. I mean, I'm defeated, that's gone, right? But the point is, it turns out that is not the case. So let's discuss how and why. But before we get there, in other words, to discuss these numbers, what we really need to do is actually think a little bit about these historic averages. Namely, what could these numbers be under, let's say, generic conditions that you think the matter that satisfies that you use to define a cosmology obeys? Well, first let's look at this equation. And this equation. Now I want to get rid of, because remember the other aspect of the formulation of the vacuum energy problem that we should be able to address in, you know, the limit of decoupling gravity and effective field theory. You want to get rid of large corrections to lambda to get a series which is now going to be radiatively stable. Radiative stability is here guaranteed. We are, you know, postponing the discussion of the largeness of the leftover for a few seconds, okay? But now, before we talk about that, let's think about the other aspect, which was that whatever we did to vacuum energy, it still needs to be much smaller than the scales that govern the particle physics that you want to preserve. Because, you know, you can, the Weinberg-Nogel theorem actually tells you, in fact, that you can get rid of all quantum corrections to vacuum energy in four-dimensional effective field theory, provided there is a clause, there is a caveat, provided that you take a conformal limit in the field theory that you use to calculate what that vacuum energy is. Namely, lambda will go to zero if all scales in the field theory you are using to calculate it go to zero simultaneously. Okay? That does happen. But that's not our world. So you want these scales to stay non-zero and significantly larger than the appropriate power of the vacuum energy that you're left with. Now notice this. I told you that this sigma should be a differentiable function. Why a differentiable function? I don't want to touch the landscape. I'll consider landscape to be a scary wasp's nest. I want to step away from this. If this were not differentiable, that means that that would be some preferred values for these solutions, that I have to find a different way to select. If it's differentiable, namely continuous, I can then just scan through these values and pick, you know, what comes naturally. There is, of course, a bit of a point as to just how sensitive you are then to initial conditions, but we can talk about that again a bit later. The trick is that as long as this is differentiable and you want finite lambda, this better not be infinite. If this were infinite, lambda would have to go to zero, and you're back to square one, and, you know, Weinberg comes and says bye. Game over, because of the fact that you're back in conformal limit. How do I make this finite? Actually, fortunately, there is a diffeomorphism invariant regulator of this integral. You need spacetimes which are compact in space and time, namely, spatially compact universes that start with a bang and end in a crunch. In fact, there is a theorem. There is a fellow, I believe Thomas Roman is the name, a gentleman in Connecticut, who actually spent a long time thinking about the conditions on various aspects of geometry calculated in the semi-classical limit, where matter is subject to certain initial certain energy conditions. And the statement is that as long as the matter that controls the evolution of the universe obeys null energy conditions, this integral will be finite. Okay? Provided, of course, that you have Cranch Bank. Moreover, these same conditions, if you have Cranch Bank, will actually guarantee not only, Cranch Bank itself will guarantee that the volume is finite. That's a fact. But Roman's theorems will actually then also tell you that this expression is finite as well. Okay? Meaning, because the big T is finite, the little t will also be finite when you take its average. And now the only question that remains is just how big finite it will be. Before we get there, though, let me now explain why I'm sticking here some generic function sigma as opposed to just a simple linear term. In fact, everything I told you so far about the actual cancellations and the variational equations and the dynamics of the theory would work just fine if I just took a linear term. The reason you don't want just the linear term is that if the function were linear, this numerator would be unity. Okay, that would make the parameter lambda that you're trying to fix a fourth power of the inverse volume of the universe. If you change the inverse volume of the universe by, let's say, one order of magnitude, which in principle isn't all that much given the genericity of the initial conditions for the evolution in GR and so on and so forth. Just imagine you had some kind of inflation. You might say, why do you even have inflation if you can't just cosmological constant? But I'll tell you that too. But if you change this by an order of magnitude, you would have suddenly to retune all of the masses in the particle sector by an order of magnitude. That'd be unpleasant, to say the least. Okay. The right kind of function that you want to have here is something that would actually exponentiate for the large argument, because then the sensitivity of the parameter lambda on the whole volume of the universe, and therefore the sensitivity of the masses to the initial conditions in the universe, would only go logarithmic. And logarithms are never bad. Okay, they're good things. So now the next step, that value, the magnitude of that parameter lambda, but before we go there, there is one other argument that I should tell you. So far, what I've been doing, basically, cooking up the action like this. Okay, it's there. Seems, I'm like pulling magic tricks out of the hat. In a way, that is what I was doing, okay, because of the fact that, you're starting from scratch and trying to tailor something up. And it seems to work. And I'm going to argue that it's going to give me a small residual cosmological constant, effective cosmological constant there. But the question, the nagging question has to be why? Where is the, what's the regulating mechanism that guarantees the inevitability of such a fact? Is this namely just a sheer accident? Or is there some, deeper level layer of dynamics which actually guarantees that such a setup would have to do the job? And the answer is, fortunately, affirmative. Because actually, there are approximate symmetries, only broken by gravity, that in fact guarantee and protect the cancellation and the residual smallness of the leftover parameter in the following way. So what are the symmetries? Now, you see, as was mentioned, standard model itself is not scale invariant. But actually, once I've introduced my auxiliary field, lowercase lambda and capital lambda, I can now talk about the scale invariance of this effective action. And I will notice that if I change, just make sure that I give you the correct statements. Too much stuff. Where is it? Here. Excellent. ignore the Einstein-Hilbert stuff. This, this, and this is invariant under that transformation. Einstein-Hilbert's part breaks it, but let, never mind that for a moment. But that's not all. This is the scaling symmetry. This actually, this scaling symmetry of this sector of the action is in fact merely the proof that all corrections to vacuum energy scale is lowercase lambda to the fourth. That actually is, and of course, in order to have that, we absolutely had to make the regulator see the same parametric dependence on lambda in its dynamics, because otherwise, without that, we would have gotten logarithmic corrections that would involve the ratios of scales involving the regulator and the particle sector, and if that dependence on lambda were different, the logs would screw everything up. So the regulator, the, seeing the same G bar, in fact, guarantees the absence of that violation of analyticity of the setup. And as a result, this is really why all the corrections go as lambda to the fourth. And then what cancels them is the shift symmetry. Which actually tells you why all such lambda to the fourth dependent pieces go away. Now, this shift symmetry is an exact part of this sector, is an exact symmetry of this sector, but not, this is not invariant. So the action actually, the action does change. The action does change, but by a term which goes as sigma prime times this parameter alpha over mu to the fourth. But now using the equation of motion for sigma prime, you can rewrite this and fixing the world volume of the universe, holding it fixed. You can do that. There is a consistent limit where you can you can see that happening. This goes as the fourth power of the ratio of the physical scales from the matter sector to the Planck scale. In the conformal limit where physical masses go to zero, this vanishes, and this is an exact symmetry of the matter sector. It's only broken by gravitational terms. This tells you that the cancellation of the vacuum energy will not be exact. The breaking will induce a residual piece. But because it is only mediated to the matter sector through gravity, from gravity through cosmology, it will be weak. So the breaking, the matter sector knows about breaking only very weakly. And you are actually having an argument for technical naturalness that in the limit where you know you are restoring conformal symmetry, sending the masses to zero, you automatically get an enhancement of the symmetry. Now, I mean, that was, again, you know, completely unexpected. Well, I'll move over. Let's now talk about, you know, demonstrating this indeed to be the case, okay? So these numbers let's just see. Ah, so these numbers that you get, this tau, let's just say we live in some, well, let's start with the assumption that the universe is big enough that, that trying to calculate this even makes sense. In other words, let's say that the universe is at least somewhat bigger, you know, involves scales somewhat longer than the Planck scale. Otherwise, none of this would make any sense at all, and then sort of see whether, you know, we're getting meaningfully self-consistent answers. Well, roughly speaking, if I assume, if you will permit me to use something like an FRW approximation where I'm, you know, describing the background geometry as an evolving cosmology in time, I know, and use the fluid approximation to describe the matter contents, which again, you know, is a leading order approximation, which we then can question whether it's valid or not under corrections from, you know, quantum effects and homogeneities, et cetera, et cetera. But that's addressable within dynamical setups when we impose energy conditions for the team mu. I can estimate this to be basically the co-moving spatial volume, which takes care of the dx, dy, dz, or whatever other spatial coordinates you prefer, okay? And it's just a number. Times something like this, the volume factor times rho, energy density. Okay, there is pressure part, but you know, for the fluids, pressures and energy density scale the same way, and as long as you have, you know, validity of the usual energy conditions, yes. Yes, 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 absolutely. Remember, I said that the space-time needs to be compact. So spatially compact universe starting at the time of the bang and ending at the time of the crunch. Yes. True.
True. So how can you have a compact?
Locally. Certainly locally. If I have a universe that's big enough, I will simply go to the largest possible Einstein elevator, and it scales shorter than the size of that elevator. I will have a very good approximate description of the world by using, you know, what seems to be unbroken Poincaré symmetry. In any cosmology, you know, explicitly Poincaré symmetry is in fact not valid. But locally on the tangent space, it always works. Now, I can give you a more formal statement here, but let's just do dimensional analysis. We can actually discuss the details if you like personally. But the bottom line is that in all of these universes, now notice what happens. A bang and crunch and a finite universe in between. In a finite universe, scale factor will be going to zero at the endpoints, but be some number, non-zero number in between. Whereas the energy density will be finite, except again the crunch and bang where it diverges. So the question is, how badly does it diverge? And of course, you know that near the end, the divergence is always quadratic in inverse square of the time. Okay. So this will go as the integral of dt times 1 over t minus t n squared. From the energy density of the universe. But it involves also a power of the co-moving volume, a cubed. That goes as, remember that if you have an equation of state given by some parameter w, near the singularities, where you ignore all the spatial effects and simply focus on the kinetic terms that dominate, the scale factor will go as power of time to the, as time to the power 2 over 3. Times 1 plus w. That's just so this will go as 2 to the, because you have to cube it, it'll go like this. Well, t minus the end. So you do this integral. You do this integral and, over there. I don't want to make a wrong statement. And you will get that this result depends t minus t end, either crunch or bang, doesn't matter. You get the same type of contribution from each limit of integration to the power minus 2w over 1 plus w. And that power is always positive, provided that w is not exceeding minus 1. Or in other words, as long as you satisfy the standard energy conditions where you're limiting W to run between 1, So as long as you limit the equation of state to essentially be in the range normally attributed to acceptable matter, this integral is fine. Actually, there is a bit of a subtlety in the case W is equal to 1, where you have actually a logarithmic divergence, which means that you have to cut the integral off, not at 0, but at Planckian times away from the crunch and bang, and then you will get a finite number. Well, no, not necessarily, probably, not necessarily. Let me give you an example, actually, that will countermand it a bit. Suppose you also have a completely massless scalar field with its zero mode excited. Near the singularity, it will behave like a fluid with the equational state W plus 1, which gives you a scaling of energy density 1 over 8 to the 6th, as opposed to 1 over 8 to the 4th. And if it's there, it will, in fact, dominate. But as long, you know, whether it's there or not, I'm just leaving this open, okay? But the bottom line is, as long as it satisfies these conditions, you will never get a large contribution. In fact, generically, the endpoints contribute nothing because of the fact that the power is positive. And the integral, essentially what happens is that even though the energy density is diverging from the squeezing of the space and time, the volume shrinks faster. And that's really what these energy conditions give you. That actually the proper volume is shrinking faster than the divergence, and so you never get any issues from that. And so actually, this integral turns out to be dominated by the values of T mu mu near the turning point, near where the expansion turns into contraction, which is very interesting because it tells you that the natural scale for the residual cosmological constant that your friend the astronomer measures is this. And if you make the universe grow very old and big, compact notwithstanding, that doesn't matter, okay, this will never exceed the critical energy density here and now. Okay? And that comes as a sort of, you know, well, okay. I really hate the words free lunch, but I don't know what else to use. And it just happens to be guaranteed by the fact that the whatever you stick in T mu nu actually obeys the standard energy conditions. And in fact, this Roman theorems tell you that this remains true even if you include semi-classical correction. You know, you could worry, for example, if you consider just the Casimir effect corrections to the energy, you know, in the vacuum, they actually violate null energy condition, but not the average null energy condition. And what I'm saying is that as long as you maintain the average, namely Casimir energy never dominates over other sources of energy that are present in the system whose energy you're calculating, you will then find, in fact, that this still remains true. Of course, a very interesting speculation, not yet, you know, quite at the level where we can publish it, is, but you know, if there is something that tells us that the age of the universe is not going to be much longer than it is now, you're kind of getting a scale for the residual cosmological constant in the range of the why now. The reason this is not so simple is, of course, that the sign of this term is controlled by the equational state of whatever dominates the universe for longest, and it can be either plus or minus, and all possibilities are there. And then, of course, you have to have some sort of a statement of just why the universe will, you know, first of all, how do you make it big, okay? And secondly, why, you know, what would make it live, you know, not much more than 10 billion years, okay? Now, let's just mention, okay, I'm going to do this in words. I'm not going to write any equations. I'm simply going to assume that you know this stuff. How do you make it big? Well, you see, the problem here is, okay, I've just claimed to cancel the cosmological constant, classical, quantum, it doesn't matter. But a perfect way to make a big universe is to inflate it. But to inflate, you need something that is going to fake a cosmological constant for an awful time, awful long time, okay? And I've just gotten rid of it, right? Well, actually, I've gotten rid of the cosmological constant contributions from a certain sector of the theory. So now, okay, that gives you the obvious idea that maybe you can add another sector, unprotected sector, okay, whose vacuum energy you are not, you know, touching, okay, that you know, will then lead to, you know, inflation, etc., where your protected sector will be a mere spectator. Okay. But the problem is that whatever agent inflated the universe, it needs to reheat the protected sector. So it must couple to the protected sector directly in some way. And then you have immediately a concern about the cross-contamination from the loops. Because I want to maintain some semblance of honesty by basically saying that if I'm going to put in some other sectors in the theory that are not really gravity, I must go on and actually include their quantum corrections too. And if now quantum corrections cross-contaminate through the loops involving interactions between protected and unprotected sector and change the dependence of the parameters on the parameter lambda, I can start getting the contribution to vacuum energy that involve interference between the two sectors, which will kill the cancellation. Actually, a remarkably simple way out of this conundrum, consistent with the philosophy that we are adopting of working within the semi-classical limit of gravity, is to say, take an extra sector, extra term, and add it to that action. Take, let's say, n number times r squared, or in other words, Starobinsky. Now, it's a sort of ridiculous thing, you know. Starobinsky inflation is this sort of funny setup, the first inflation ever found without realizing that it was inflation, but eventually getting to the point of that being it, which the data like anyway. I'm just going to tell you that essentially Starobinsky inflation goes through with absolutely minuscule modifications in the setup. And everything just works. The oddity about this, of course, is that it sort of makes you wonder, okay, now, what are the predictions other than the cancellation of the vacuum energy? But notice what I told you. In order to actually have a chance of arguing that you have a reasonable, well, acceptable phenomenology, reasonable is too strong a word, you must get up there, finite lambda or space-time compact universe that collapses. To see, now, does that mean that if a universe does not collapse, I don't have solutions? No. The solutions where the universe is open and expands forever are perfectly fine solutions of the theory. They're allowed, they're not excluded, there is no obstruction to them, except for the fact that in all such universes, where is this? Well, somewhere, okay? In all such universes, this integral will diverge, and the residual cosmological constant, this average space-time average of tau mu mu, will go to zero, which by itself is fine, but there will be no gap in the particle sector. The particle sector will be massless. So that is not our universe. So you have to make a statement about some, well, I would argue, mild statement about the initial conditions, that you have to start with a spatially compact universe. And there are some old arguments of why that might be better than an, you know, infinite universe anyway, dealing with, you know, likelihood of making a finite size universe versus infinite size universe in quantum gravity. And then in such a universe, you need to end it. And if you end it, then you are going to get finite particle masses, not vanishing particle masses. Which actually tells you what the prediction is if you turn it around. Because it actually tells you that, you know, the notice in particle sector, you see nothing. Because of the fact that all you are doing is introducing extra functional dependence on the world volume of the universe, which as far as particles are concerned is a number that they absorb into their local definition of what their mass is. Because, you know, when you look, compare this to a standard of the mass, you are always dealing with ratios and this parameter lambda cancels. Okay? The prediction is in the statement that if you accept, you say, okay, this shall be the theory of the world, then observing that the electron has a finite mass means that in the future universe will implode. Okay, so in a sense, you know, what you're saying is you go to your friend, the astronomers, and you're telling them, OK, Okay, go look for the signs of the impending doom in the sky. If you can see them. Yes.
To recollapse if you generate a cosmological constant.
Remember the sign. That sign there doesn't necessarily have to be positive. It could be a negative cosmological constant. No. I understand now your question. Sorry. That what you measure is not necessarily, what is this? Just this. What you measure is perhaps a combination of some, you know, terms from here and here referring to that as the vacuum energy. In particular, one example that will actually perform perfectly well is, as a matter of fact, the original, like ever, the first ever, as far as I know, proposed model of dark energy before it was called dark energy from 86, linear potential. Add a linear potential to your setup, make it protected. You gain from the setup, in fact, that because the quasi-shift symmetry of the linear potential in this setup actually becomes exact. So you're getting an extra benefit from, you know, protecting it from loop corrections, okay? And you will find actually that that linear potential not only can turn over the expansion into contraction because of the fact that, you know, once you go through zero, eventually the negativity builds up and takes over from the kinetic energy, but an extra, and this I'm saying it seems because this is not yet complete, okay? It seems that the stage of collapse is actually preceded precisely by a stage of accelerated expansion. Yes? Calculable prediction, I think, yes. That's why something we're trying to figure out precisely how to do. Okay, you know, technology is not my strong suit. I really want to make sure that, you know, if I am trying to say something sufficiently precise that it's actually right. Okay, but one other possibility that we were considering, okay, since we're saying, look, we have, I mean, now this is, I'm gonna hallucinate, okay, if you don't mind, okay? So what other predictions can we have, okay? Well, we have a space-time compact universe, you know, the collapse is one of the indications. How do you look for the collapse? Obviously, one other prediction is the fact that W equals minus one is not eternal. It's merely a transient, it will change. Dark energy does not dominate the universe forever, because if it did, the universe would expand forever, leading to these infinities in the world volume metric, and vanishing of the effective cosmological constant, and vanishing of the particle sector masses. That doesn't happen. So how W not equal to minus one, and the presence of these deviations would in fact be a prediction. Yet another prediction is, this is dubious, okay? The attempts to make it work so far that we have tried failed. I'll tell you why, okay? We need a compact space. Now, we would like let's say that the argument for the universe not being, you know, infinitely, well, you know, a gazillion years old before it collapses, but not much more than 10 billion years old, is the standard story of, you know, this is weak entropics, okay? So I'm, you know, coming clean right up front, okay? It's not really a prediction I will defend with my life, but it's a consequence of the fact that I'm here and that it might be difficult to get a universe that is going to be much older than it is now, simply because of the field theoretic issues in doing so. Namely, as you know, I mean, getting much more than 65 folds of inflation is always a bit of a challenge. So suppose you have some minimal model inflation. You do Starobinsky 65 folds. That tells you that after that, okay, you know, you do have some memory of the initial conditions in there that you have not erased completely. That may turn things around, okay? And you say, okay, now since I live in a compact space, maybe that scale of compactness is not that much bigger than the current Hubble scale. If that's so, maybe I'm affecting something at the on the sky at the largest scales. What could it be? Well, how about low power at LOELS, right? Now you go and you look, what would be the simple setup? Take a torus, okay? The torus doesn't work. The torus fails absolutely miserably in attempting to reduce the power at low L's. Intuitively, for a very simple reason, okay? Basically, so when you do the Fourier transform, okay, the only effect you expect can be given by a one-dimensional, by a power of a dimensionless number, which is given by the ratio of the Hubble scale to the size of the torus. the periodicity of the torus. Now you stick in there the bounds from the absence of multiplication of images in the sky, and you find that, let's say, that number is, you know, half. And then since you're trying to affect, at the earliest, the quadruple, okay, you find that, you know, your number goes down as 1 over 2 to the 4. And for the octave 1, in other words, it just goes away real quick, okay? So torus doesn't work. We tried sphere. There was a paper by George Evstatyan from around 2004 where he actually speculated that the sphere, you know, might lead to the reduction, okay? And it doesn't, okay? A precise calculation shows it doesn't, and actually George told me personally that, you know, he was just guessing, okay? Why is this? The problem is that if you actually look at the harmonic oscillator either on a sphere or on a torus, you actually find that the levels or the states of the theory, okay, which you're now discretized, are equidistant independent of which L you're looking at. So, you know, if you make a torus slightly bigger than the horizon scale, you lose one or two modes. Most of them are still there. And, you know, you can dump the power in them, and that's why it really doesn't work. Well, there is an example where you actually do something a bit other, but nobody seems to have been able to, or did. If you know better, tell me, please. But, you know, calculate the answer. Compact hyperbolic spaces. In compact hyperbolic spaces at low Ls, you know, I mean, the levels are in fact equidistant at high Ls, but not at low Ls. Because the complicated topology imposes very complicated boundary conditions which project many, many levels that would have been naively there. So that's kind of an idea for a prediction. If I knew how to calculate the spectrum on a compact hyperbolic space, then I could hope that there will be a significant, more significant reduction, even if I satisfy the bounds from the absence of multiplication of images, simply because of the fact that I have fewer channels to dump the power into. Okay, but let me. I should probably stop here. Okay.
I guess you can generalize it when you have more than one physical scale.
So again, sorry?
What happens when you have more than one physical scale? I guess you can just introduce different lambdas or...
In principle, yeah, okay, let's go in some more in that vein. Absolutely true. You can have different sectors that at least in principle can have dependence on these different lambdas.
I mean, in a certain sense, I really think of this potentially as a useful tool in a model builder's arsenal. How useful remains to be seen in terms of the possible dangers that this acausality may or may not introduce, okay?
And another question, so you predict values for both small lambda and large lambda, and that seems to fix it. Once you observe blank mass, seems to fix the scale, auxiliary scale M, right?
You mean that this parameter M or mu, right? Yes.
You still this mu. Can you make an estimation of what the value of mu would be?
I can give you some estimates for the possibilities. Imagine that you take your protective sector to have M Planck as the cutter. Okay. If you take M Planck to be the actual cutoff of the theory, okay. And then you would expect that the vacuum energy you want to cancel is of the order of M1
to the fourth, give or take. Okay. Now you need to have the universe to where is this number? Well, it's somewhere. I'd written down that equation. Well, I'll just copy over the equation. There was this sigma prime and lambda, and this was equal to t mu mu, etc. And there was some lowercase lambda to the fourth and mu to the fourth, etc. You need to have the universe which is at least about, let's say, order of magnitude more long-lived than the one that we occupy, roughly, okay? In order to get the phenomenology to reflect this, you need to pick mu to be of order about, an order of magnitude below M Planck. If you choose that function sigma to be roughly exponential for large arguments. The alternative would be, again, it depends on the playing with phenomenology, which we did, you know, very crudely, okay? If you take the scale, if you take the cutoff to be about TeV, then obviously, you know, that parameter mu should be about TeV without...
Do you think mu could be...
Well, ultimately, yes. But I'll tell you, I have, you know, I have to, okay. In order to do that, I have to go beyond this mechanics of the theory that I've described to you. I mean, I've given you basically semi-classical dynamics. To actually be able to tell what goes on there, I need more, okay?
Where could actions like this come out, where you are actually thinking of, you know, parameters, the scale, the dimensional parameters that control the gravitational sector to behave like Lagrange multipliers, which sort of vary over the phase space of quantum gravity? Actually, if you took that action I have on top of the board, and instead of choosing to write it in terms of the metric G, which I like because of the fact that it points out the scaling dependence of the standard model or of the protected sector, okay, on the dimensions, rewrite it in terms of G bar. Then what happens, in terms of G bar, obviously the matter sector remains, you know, just commonplace. No. What you end up doing is dividing M Planck by 2 power of lambda. So really, by saying that you are allowing the variation with respect to lowercase lambda and capital lambda, what you're actually saying is that in your full quantum gravity phase space, it's actually M Planck and capital lambda that vary. Do we know an example of that? Yes, Kalmanian wormholes. Okay, but in the usual applications of the Kalmanian wormhole calculus, what they assume, even though actually both all of these things will change in the presence of such structures, such objects, okay, then would normally hold M Planck fixed and simply focus on the, you know, quantum dependence of lambda on the, you know, wormhole structures put in there and try to compute the vacuum energy, blah, 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 you know, predictions for the wave function, et cetera, from this. What I'm saying is I would like to see if this, you know, can actually be consistently embedded with the story I'm telling in that type of framework. In that case, I could hope to be able to actually, you know, figure out, I mean, incidentally, you know, in a very simple term, you actually can, in all of these cases, integrate out capital lambda and lowercase lambda explicitly and write down the action in terms of only the metric and the fields. That's clear. Of course, that action would look somewhat nonlinear. That settling action I mentioned is an example, but it had the wrong scaling. In fact, just as a sort of, you know, point in case, settling story was take the standard action of gravity, standard Einstein-Hilbert action with, you know, vacuum energy in there, with Lagrangian for the matter and whatnot, and just divide the whole thing by the whole volume of the universe. Okay? And then the lambda term, pull it out, becomes explicitly metric independent and does not contribute to the equations of motion. But this is only the classical lambda term. Where Zetlin fails is that when you actually consistently consider how the quantum corrections go with the as the function also the determinant G, this independence of lambda on the determinant of G, it turns out to be only true at the classical level. Quantum corrections depend on the root G and they contribute. Okay? And the trick was that he actually did not have the right scaling with lowercase lambda in the setup. But you know, if you do this, if I just took a linear function, just to give you an idea, if I took the linear sigma, which phenomenologically is a bad thing because of the sensitivity to initial conditions, but I just do it for an example, and I integrate out lowercase lambda and capital lambda, and I rewrite the whole Lagrangian, I imagine that matter is just the standard model Lagrangian, which has only one scale, the Higgs wave, then all that happens is that all I do is I take the Higgs wave and I replace it by itself divided by the 4th power of the world volume of the universe. That's all. Remarkable. Yes?
You do an Euclidean momentum, Euclidean space. The problem is when you do that, you end up with a remainder that's infinite. It doesn't work. That was the conclusion of this paper.
Okay.
Secondly, in your paper, which I looked at, you claim that you can cancel the vacuum energy completely as it couples to gravity.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you weigh the hydrogen atom and the gravity field of the Earth, then this was pointed out by Polchinski in 2006, that you have the bubble crack, the the gravitons tadpole. Mm-hmm. When you compare that to the vacuum polarization, and you have a graviton attached to the internal loop, then you violate the Kurvitz principle by
no, not in this setup.
In generic situations, that's an issue. Not in this setup, because of the fact the only modification of the equations of motion is the introduction of that historical integral, which in fact guarantees that the problem that you're bringing up, which is indeed a generic worry, will not happen. That dynamical process is simply just canceled out completely from the theory. It's identical to the standard stuff. It's identical to the standard stuff. I'm simply telling you that I'm canceling the source in the gravitational equations of motion. Like I told you, yes, but the only thing that happens through this change is the shift of the source of the gravitational equations of motion, which already includes consistently, it has full knowledge of all the quantum corrections. So there is, as long as I'm only considering external graviton lines, there is no problem. The process that you're talking about is not an issue. I told you right off the bat that if I consider virtual gravitons, my story fails.
Ah, okay. So we agree.
Perhaps we do. I'm not sure. If you agree, like I said, that was my opening statement. No. Well, okay. Now let's go into that, since you bring it up. That's okay. I mean, you know, how could I try to fix this? You know, I need something to cancel this process. Maybe, just maybe, but I don't know this works, okay? Maybe I can actually take the unprotected sector, which involves the graviton, and I can supersymmetrize it. Now, I don't know that I can supersymmetrize theories with such auxiliary fields a priori. But I don't know of any a priori reason which tells me that this is impossible. If I can do that, then, okay, all of the virtual graviton processes that are problematic and that here kill this once they're included, okay, will actually start getting regulated down to whatever the supersymmetry scale, breaking scale is in the gravitational sector. Now, if you manage to construct a setup within which something like this is realized, which may or may not exist, okay? And you break supersymmetry at some very low scale, okay? You may not get any worse contributions to the effective residual vacuum energy, including full quantum gravity, worse than that breaking scale to the fourth. We know gravity only down to the millimeter. Who knows, maybe it's supersymmetric below a millimeter. Not for gravity. No, the LHC shows something about LHC shows some. I'm not supersymmetrizing the standard model. I'm supersymmetrizing the hidden sector involving gravity. Yes, of course. Yes. Eternal inflation is nasty here. Is nasty. Eternal inflation will generically, so I want setups where inflation cannot be eternal. Not always. No, not necessarily. Depends on which potential you write down. In particular, Starobinsky inflation is not eternal. But it's an issue. Eternal inflation is the enemy because it would actually tend to make the overall volume of everything infinite, and then you know you're sort of saying, okay, I give up, you know.